Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. In Western theologies, it is considered almost heresy to refer to the divine as anything but male when speaking formally. There is universal consensus that God has no real gender. But because the various scriptures use male imagery almost exclusively, the concept of a father figure is difficult to avoid. In her new book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism, author Nila Bhattacharya Saxena examines how the lack of a feminine form of the sacred impacts how the Abrahamic religions are expressed. A little bit about our guest. Dr. Nila Bhattacharya Saxena is professor of English and Women's Studies at Nassau Community College in New York. She wrote her 2004 book, In the Beginning is Desire, tracing Kali's footprints in Indian literature, to communicate her connection with a much misunderstood fierce Indian goddess. She continued her explorations of goddesses in her other publications, such as Mystery, Wonder, and Knowledge in the Triadic Figure of Mahavidya Chinnamasta, a Shakta woman's reading. We welcome to Common Threads Nila Bhattacharya Saxena. Hello, Nila.
Hello, Fred. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Certainly. In reading this book, it's very clear that your prior books influenced this so much. I want to be clear to the audience that this is indeed a standalone book. However, you have to agree that reading your other books really preps you in a particular way to be able to read Absent Mother God of the West, correct?
Yes.
So tell us a bit about your spiritual journey and how you ended up being this Kali Bhakta, as they say.
Yes. Well, actually, when I was a child growing up in India, and I have written about that in many other parts, actually, in Color of God, a kind of autobiographical essay. But I never thought of talking about that until I came to the United States. And that is the journey that is so fascinating. In India, I was growing up, you know, normal child with hundreds of deities. My father actually was a Kali devotee. As a result, every, Amavasya night, we will go to the Kali temple, and it was just a routine. But certain things started to happen to me. I was always a curious child, and I wanted to know what all these things actually meant. So that was a whole personal journey that was going on. And then when I was in my 20s, I had a kind of a radical experience that I mentioned in my first Kali book, which I did not understand at that point. And I began searching. And it was totally personal. I was doing my PhD, I was reading books, and somehow ended up with books on Tantra. And I didn't know anything about those, actually. Nobody even mentioned that. Because in India, usual story is that when you seek and ask, then the answers come. Nobody, you know, tells you about. But it was when I came to the United States, and slowly and slowly, even though I knew about the biblical God, of course, understood that it's a father God, but the impact, the immensity did not occur to me, especially when people kept telling me that how a female God does not matter at all to women. That did not sit very well with me. Excuse me. And every time I ask people casually whether at conferences, students, about their God, they said, yes, that is a father God. And whenever, and then they will explain, this is a spirit, there is no gender. So they say, if there is no gender, can you imagine that God in a female form? It should be fine, right, either way. And they said, no. And that was very strange to me. So I had this double experience. On the one hand, I was seen as a third world oppressed woman, with all kinds of goddesses that did not matter to me. The scholarly work I was reading, they also said something similar. So I was very kind of intrigued by that. So during this personal journey, I began to take a kind of a more public shape. I started to talk about it, go to conferences, and then I ended up at a Kali conference in New York. And that was probably the catalyst when I thought maybe this Indian woman should talk about Kali, about her personal journey. So that's how the first book got written.
Briefly, this Kali conference, were you one of several Hindus there? Were you one of several women? Or was it very academic? Would you say the majority of people there were more focused on the academic, on the scholarly, as opposed to being devotees?
Yes, it was an academic conference. I just happened to find out about it. I was just one of the, attendees there. I wasn't a speaker, and it was mainly a scholarly conference.
Okay. And let me back up just a minute. Did I misread something in the book? I thought that your experiences as a younger person were in Bangladesh as opposed to India. What am I missing?
No, I grew up in India. My family's background is what is now Bangladesh.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes, your family.
My mother had to leave everything after partition. So I grew up hearing the stories about that.
Okay. Did you ever spend time in Bangladesh?
I haven't.
Okay. Okay. It was your family. That's what I'm remembering. Thank you. So what's interesting here is that in the Hindu pantheon, there are multiple goddesses. Let's forget about the male gods for a moment, but the goddesses,
right,
the devis. And some of them are, the imagery is so beautiful. If this was television, we put up a picture of Lakshmi who's sitting on a lotus leaf, her skin milky white, and just looks so beneficent, just looks so, sweet. And then you also mentioned in your book, Saraswati, the goddess of learning, of wisdom, of art. Once again, a very attractive-looking woman with a swan, a rosary in her hand and a book in her hand and playing a musical instrument. Isn't it rather challenging to express to people your devotion for a goddess that looks so terrifying? First of all, as opposed to the other goddesses I just mentioned, Kali is midnight black, and she has a necklace of skulls, human skulls, or sometimes I've even seen actual human heads around her neck. She has weapons in her hand, and often she is seen standing with her foot over a form which happens to be Shiva. She just looks so menacing. And my understanding is that Westerners who first came to India, who observed this Kali worship, they perceived it to be sort of a worship me or I'm going to get you sort of theology. So are there challenges for having such a fierce deity, and what does that ferocity symbolize?
Very good question. Yes, actually I realize that anybody who first sees Kali will be intimidated and superimpose whatever their own conditioning is onto that figure. And I began to recognize how in India you have layers and layers and layers of meaning. And the imagery is symbolic at some point. And even that symbolic meaning is dependent on whether it is coming from the Puranas, which are all these stories, mythical stories, whether it is a philosophical reading, or whether it is a tantric meaning. So Kali's fierce form, actually all the fierce deities in India, and it's not just Kali, there are many, many fierce deities. Kali is probably the most well-known and most intense. of them all. The fierce form is actually a kind of protection. She is the great mother who combines both polarities in herself, and all polarities merge and vanish. But most people do not want to cross the threshold into the abyss, into a form. I have written in my first book that people are afraid that she's this devouring goddess. And I have said, once Kali devours you, you have nothing to fear. Because she is that ultimate reality. And that reality even goes beyond the notion of Brahman, which is the manifest universe, the, you know, which is still consciousness is benign. She is the very root of it all. That's known as Adya Kali. So if we are looking at the figure, a lot of people in Bengal worship her as mother. They are not afraid of her. They are, and those who are afraid of her, they will, you know, it's part of the entire psycho-spiritual dynamic, actually, of the psyche, of the human personality. So the figure, you know, because she makes you face two very powerful forces in our human experience, or any experience, which is death and sexuality. At its very raw, what I would say, suchness, the very suchness of these two forces. So, of course, there are all kinds of confusion, all kinds of fear. So, for some reason, I ended up going through an experience, a breakthrough experience, which was very frightening, but at the same time, it took me to a completely different understanding of Kali. And then I began to read books that explain the meaning, why she's wearing these skulls, why there is sometimes, you know, fresh human head, sometimes there are, you know, skulls there, and there, how many different kinds of, there are 100 different kinds of Kalis in India.
So talk about, let's say, the most well-known of the symbols, such as the necklace of skulls holding a human head and the weapons and standing on Shiva. Is it always, does she always stand on Shiva, or does she stand on other figures as well? Because, again, there are multiple understandings of Kali, multiple images and icons of Kali. I'm curious.
Right,
if,
there are
if,
multiple.
Yeah. Yes,
there are multiple icons of Kali, actually. But the Shiva figure, again, as I said, Shiva, at the mythic level, the story is that actually this is a combined image. It is an image, in many ways, a yin-yang figure. So the black and the white combined together, that's the one level of understanding. Then there is another level of understanding that in the Tantric or Shakta India, it is the feminine principle that is the active force in the universe. And the masculine force is a completely passive form. So Shiva, actually, there is a Sanskrit word Shava, which means dead body. So the being remains a Shava until Kali, there is also linguistic mysticism here, the E sound, when Kali's foot touches the Shava aspect, it becomes Shiva, that is pure consciousness. So it is in some ways the Shakti aspect that is invigorating consciousness, so consciousness and energy become together and awake. So this is the awakening of the entire being. It's like, you know, awakening to your Buddha nature, your Shiva nature. And then, of course, there are other esoteric meanings of it. And that's where multiple figures come up. Sometimes you see, you know, Sadashiva. And again, I am not even, I'm just a beginner student, actually, in the esoteric tantras. So I don't even know the other meanings. But the skulls also refer to the Sanskrit letters, because there are all kinds of meaning. There are wonderful books that are available explaining how the sound element, the entire aspect of different letters in those heads, and how pronouncing, say, Om, you know, how that creates kind of healing energy in you. But those are tantric mantras connected with tantric mantras that I'm not, you know, familiar with.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Nila Bhattacharya Saxena, and we're talking about her book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism. Let's talk about Tantra then, because that is something that, either it's understood or it's misunderstood in the West. But it has the reputation of being sort of a sexual yoga. Recently, there was a temple. Now, they didn't advertise themselves as a Hindu temple. They didn't use the word Hindu at all. It was run by Anglo-Americans. I think it was in Arizona. This is about a month ago or so, where this organization that referred to itself as a Tantra temple was busted by the cops, because while they claimed that what was going on was Tantra, was some sort of religious activity, the police deigned it to be a brothel, and that what was going on was really just a cover for prostitution. Did you hear about that?
No, I haven't heard about that particular thing, but I am very familiar with this hypersexualization of Tantra.
Yes.
In the West. And in some aspects, there was, you know, one of the reasons why this word has such a bad name is all the confusion around it. So unfortunately, the history of Tantra is very messy. As I said, Kali makes you face sexuality and death and helps you transcend that. Not repress, not suppress, not deny, but transmute these energies. Now, the sexual yoga is such a complex thing, I don't even have a clue what that is. Because the tradition that I have, the practices that I have, the meditation practices given to me by my guru, they are completely about going within your own being and actually slowly and slowly go through a kind of calming down of your entire being. So what happens, though, in this confusion about sexuality is that, and again, I have mentioned that a few times in my earlier book also, is one that there is this sudden exoticizing of some sort of an Eastern tradition that is going to, you know, just legitimize any kind of sexual behavior. So that is one aspect. The other aspect, of course, is in India, the fear is, in India it is always, the Tantra is some sort of black magic, you know, so there is sex, black magic, because there is tremendous amount of confusion around the tradition, because there's not enough knowledge. It's an ultimate liberatory knowledge. It is the highest achievement of the Indic sensibility. And it is there at every tradition. It is the methodology, how to realize, say, the non-duality, the notion of Advaita, non-duality in Vedanta. One is a theoretical aspect. Tantra is the practice aspect. How do you actualize it? In India, whether Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, Jain, any dharma, is not a theory. But that doesn't mean everybody is on that path. When people are on that path, it's only a teacher who can initiate you into the mystery, into the actualization. So that is the aspect. And Tantra, too, is not one. There are many, many levels of Tantra. People do not know that Tibetan Buddhism is a complete Tantric Vajrayana tradition. You know, my guru who initiated me, he belongs to the Indian lineage of Vajrayana tradition, Vajrayana, which is completely Tantric Buddhism. So the confusion comes from lack of knowledge, but then it is also commercialized. People are selling Tantra chocolate these days. I see that it has become buzzword now. So that's, I think, the root of it. And again, I sometimes jokingly tell people that if in India, if you ask somebody, you know, you're interested in the tantras, the guru will send you to the cremation ground, not to some sort of a sexual, you know, escapade there. You sit in a cremation ground for a night. Well, that will you know, cure people of their fascination for Tantra. Or if the seeking is real, then you will face death.
You bring up your guru in your book over and over. You pay great respect and obeisances to this gentleman who is your guru. And
right.
It's interesting because I know that there has been, particularly in the West more than in the East, a bit of a backlash against male gurus because it seems
right.
patriarchal, and certainly there have been plenty of people who have worn the label of guru who have not acted appropriately and have taken advantage of women devotees, not just sexually but emotionally. Can you respond to that and how you, as a woman, as a feminist, as a Kali Bhakta, a devotee, how are you comfortable with having a man as a guru?
Right. Yes. Again, you know, a murky world there. A lot of gurus are human beings and, you know, exploitation, power play, a lot of things are part of that game. And that is why actually I would warn people not to walk into that path with any kind of colored lenses. First of all, this is not a joke. People should not be approaching these very radical transformative paths. That is why Kali has this fierce form. It's actually to protect people. Don't go there unless you are ready. In the Indian system, it says when you are ready, the guru arrives. In my case, that happened. I didn't seek a guru. I didn't even know what I was doing. It was the synchronicity of it all is like amazing. So in the Indian system, there's all, okay, you've been doing these practices, and then what I understand from my guru, that there are various gurus who are giving various kinds of teachings to prepare people. So what he calls like a general, you know, vitamin, some sort of that helps you get out of your, you know, the suffering that you are going through. But the tantric guru is a special who looks at you, diagnoses your particular situation, and gives you a mantra that is going to help you. But one of the first things in this path that people have to drop their gender identity. So the male, the female, and again, for that you have to go to the Buddhist texts. It is in the Buddhist texts that things are very clear. Buddhist tantras are, again, which is known as the Tarakula, retain the purest form of tantra according to my guru. So what happens there is that slowly the purification rituals take place. Through the mantras, through the meditation practices, you slowly purify and transmute. It has absolutely nothing to do with male and female. Female guru, there are wonderful female gurus in India. I mean, great Anandamayima, my guru's highest, you know, the form that he gives to Brahmamayima, there are female gurus. But in that path, the gendered identity has to be dropped. The very first thing people have to drop is their. I think I had mentioned at one point that as soon as somebody takes the Kali mantra, both the caste and gender identities fall off your body. It actually goes completely against the Brahminical caste ideas or, you know, kind of a, you can call it the hierarchy of gender. Without dropping those, you cannot practice. You cannot enter the Kali practices, even at the basic level. Forget about the deeper tantric levels.
We should mention, too, that you just brought up Buddhism, that in your book you talk about your spiritual path as sort of bridging the two religions, both Hinduism and Buddhism. You share an identity with both, which really is much more common in that part of the world than
right.
people think, particularly in Nepal and other places where the two seem to merge. And your guru's path and the path that you have adopted shares much with, you just mentioned earlier, Tibetan Buddhist tantric practice, correct?
Right.
What about the idea of temple worship? When you enter into the path that you have, are you still drawn to Hindu temples, or is it more of a private sadhana practice that you have now?
Oh, no. Temple worship is very integral to that. You do not discard anything. It is an integral practice. The beauty, the grandeur of the rituals, whether... See, the word Hindu, you know, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh, these are identity-forming names. And if you know about the Dharma traditions, the goal is to drop all identity. You cannot have a religious identity and reach moksha or nirvana. Or, you know, these are simply, you know, forms there. So even within the vast area of Hinduism, there's so many different paths. So just because, so this is something, again, a very important distinction. I again ask my students, well, the Hindus and Buddhists, there you could be practically Hindu and Buddhist, and the ancient tradition, people practice so many different things at the same time. You know, Sikhs also, and especially the mother figures, actually. One of the arguments I make is that the mother principle is beyond all religious boundaries. You know, the identity, religious identity, the extreme kind of loyalty to a particular group is broken completely. She is the mystic river where all religions dissolve and create this, you know, a totally different understanding of reality, both internal and external.
Neela, I'm sorry. We are actually out of time for this week, but this is so fascinating, and I am certainly going to invite you back next week, and I'll let you continue discussing all of this because it is so so fascinating. But thank you so much for your time with us this week.
Thank you very much, Fred. This was a great, great pleasure. And I appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and we've been speaking with Neela Bhattacharya Saxena about her book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Hinduism. For more information on Neela's work, you can go to her blog at neelabsaxena.blogspot.com. Join us again next week here on WGVU.